From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what it's like when your mother forgets she's related to you. We talk with Deborah Hoffman about her new documentary, Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter, a video journal about her relationship with her mother, who has Alzheimer's disease. The film was nominated for an Academy Award and will be shown Tuesday on PBS. Also, how the granddaughter of a former U.S. president fell in love with and married the former head of the Soviet space program, under the observation, of course, of the KGB and CIA. We talk with Susan Eisenhower. And Stephen Levy, Newsweek technology columnist, tells us about the basic necessities to surf the internet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida officials report Tropical Storm Allison has flooded dozens of homes along the Gulf Coast. Allison hit the panhandle early today, flooding streets and spinning off tornadoes before weakening from hurricane status. State officials say water rose 7 to 8 feet within 90 minutes as the storm surge hit the coast. The rush of water flooded homes and businesses. The National Hurricane Center says the storm will likely cross Georgia and possibly South Carolina before blowing into the Atlantic later tomorrow. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says if work on an anti-terrorism bill isn't finished by the end of the day tomorrow, he'll pull it off the table. The legislation is Washington's response to the Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people.
Complaining about delay may make for good politics, but what we need from the president are not words, but leadership. Because I want to fulfill the president's request. I want to pass the anti-terrorism bill promptly, without delay. But if we're going to accomplish this goal, the president will have to move off the sidelines and get into the game, because we need his help.
But President Clinton says Republicans are stalling the bill. He's calling on both Republicans and Democrats to stop making the matter a political football.
I call upon my fellow Democrats and Republicans to limit amendments, curb politics, ignore narrow interests, to agree to the simple pact that there should be no excuses, no games, no delays. The time is now to enact this important legislation.
The bill calls for expanded law enforcement authority to investigate alleged terrorism in the United States. Syndicated radio talk show host Sonny Block has pleaded innocent to charges he defrauded listeners out of millions of dollars. Block is accused of using his financial advice show to promote investments that personally enriched him. Madeline Brand of member station WBGO reports.
Federal authorities say Sonny Block and four others bilked investors out of $21 million. They're accused of using Block's radio program to promote investments into a wireless cable company that failed, largely, prosecutors say, because Block and his partners kept a lot of the money. Block also is accused of hiding the fact that he was being paid to promote the company. Block was heard on some 200 stations nationwide until he was deported from the Dominican Republic last week. He maintains his innocence, saying he's sorry people lost their money, but he was not responsible. A separate class action lawsuit against Block is pending. For now, he remains in jail, a judge today refusing to grant bail until after a later hearing. For National Public Radio, this is Madeline Brand in Newark, New Jersey.
The president of Serbia says it's likely Bosnian Serbs will soon free more than 250 peacekeepers they're holding hostage. The Serbian president says Bosnian Serb leaders have responded positively to his proposals. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 26 points at 4,471. This is NPR. A union representing government employees has drawn up a list of items that its members want changed in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The American Federation of Government Employees says many of its members are anxious about their safety at work following the bombing. The union has drawn up a list of suggestions to improve security. It wants cars and trucks kept away from the perimeter of federal buildings, and it's calling for a shift away from the use of contract security guards, preferring instead to use police officers who've been screened by the Justice Department. Union President John Sturtevant says budget constraints should not be a consideration.
And we're not going to link this to costs. You know, the security of federal employees is priceless.
Sturtevant also called on talk show hosts and members of Congress to turn down the rhetoric against government employees. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
Talk show host G. Gordon Liddy is calling on Americans to defy any attempt by the federal government to take their weapons. Liddy spoke at a rally yesterday in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Committee of 1776. That's a coalition of groups fighting gun control. They see movements to limit guns as infringements on their constitutional rights. Authorities say about 1,000 people attended the rally. Liddy, who was one of dozens of speakers, also suggested people speak repeatedly to their lawmakers against gun control. The Food and Drug Administration says non-prescription drugs with easier-to-understand labels are reaching consumers. The FDA says the new labels tell consumers at a glance how to properly use a non-prescription drug, what its side effects are, and when to see a doctor. The new labels are mostly voluntary for over-the-counter drugs. The FDA decided last week its proposals were getting enough support so that it will start the year-long process of writing regulations to force the change for all over-the-counter medications. The agency is experimenting with label designs. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Imagine what it's like to have a mother who no longer comprehends that she's related to you. That's the position Deborah Hoffman is in. Her mother, who is now in her mid-80s, has Alzheimer's disease. When her mother's memory started to go haywire, Deborah Hoffman started a video journal to show how the disease was changing her mother and their relationship. She made the journal into a documentary film called Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter. The film was nominated for an Academy Award and will be shown Tuesday night on the PBS series POV. Hoffman has also worked as a film editor on such acclaimed documentaries as The Times of Harvey Milk and Common Threads. This is the first movie she directed. Hoffman told me that her mother seemed to lose her memory chronologically.
The first things that happened were just a loss of extreme short-term memory. So, you know, literally, what did you do a minute before? What did you say a minute before? So she would become very, very repetitive because she would repeat what she'd said the minute before. And then it just kept going backwards. And what remained the longest were the memories of her childhood and her teenage years. And what was kind of shocking to me was what was fairly quickly erased was what I thought of as, you know, the whole body of her life. I mean, the 50 years that she spent married to my father and you know, raising two children, that was sort of the first to disappear. And but her parents, while her children didn't remain clear to her and her husband was completely gone very quickly, her parents to this day still are in her memory.
So that whole part of her life that your life intersects with was gone.
Right. Right, which was very strange.
I want to play a clip from your film that has a lot of phone messages from your mother about a
yes.
hearing aid. Tell us what led up to these phone messages.
Well, everything for a while happened in obsessive stages. And so there would be a topic on the table and that would be it. That would be what life revolved around. So during this particular period, and I call them periods, I call this one the hearing aid period, she had a hearing aid that was broken and I had taken it away to be repaired, but I knew that she would be curious, you know, where's her hearing aid? And she would probably go into a tailspin looking for it. So I had left her notes in her apartments saying, I have your hearing aid, it's being repaired, you know, don't worry about it. But, of course, this all just led to a whole new kind of obsession, and she began phoning me rather frequently, wondering in various ways what had happened to the hearing aid. So I saved those phone messages that she left me.
And included them in your film?
Yes.
Monday, 10:30 a.m.
Debbie, I'm your mother, and I think that the hearing aid has improved, do you know?
Monday, 10:35 a.m.
I'm Doris Hoffman, Debbie Hoffman's mother, and I want to get some information on hearing aid batteries. Thank you.
Monday, 10:46 a.m.
I'm Debbie, your daughter, and I wanted to know about the hearing aid. Are you there?
Monday, 11:02 a.m.
Debbie, you were talking to me, but I wanted to find out if there's any news about the hearing aids. Did you follow or did you hang up? Bye-bye.
So what response was left for you to all of these phone messages?
Well, again, everything took a while for me to figure out how to act. So at first, you know, and so I compressed these phone messages into, you know, as if all of these messages happened within the morning of a certain day. Well, I certainly got that many messages in a morning of a certain day, but the point is that the messages actually went on for weeks. So daily, I came home from work to a tape full of messages from my mother about hearing aids. And the variety was incredible. I mean, sometimes clearly she thought I was the repair person. She forgot, you know, and she was just calling and just by stating to some stranger that she was my mother, that would open doors and give her hearing aid back. And then I do describe in the movie one of the more ludicrous things that I would do. Sometimes she would call when I wasn't at work. I was home, and I picked up the phone, and she would launch into, "Where's my hearing aid? I need my hearing aid." And as I describe in the film, probably the dumbest thing I ever did was say, "Well, you know, I wrote you a note about your hearing aid. Why don't you go and find the note, and then I'll talk to you about the note." Well, so that meant I sent her away from the phone. And, of course, she's then in her apartment away from the phone, no longer remembers what she's been sent to find. And I'm left with this phone hanging, and I'm kind of calling louder and louder, trying to get her to hear and come back to the phone, and, of course, she can't hear because she doesn't have her hearing aid. So it was just this insane situation. It was utterly out of control.
Who was your mother before she got Alzheimer's?
Well, she was very different, obviously, but she was very different in some fundamental ways that are interesting. In terms of just who she was a very educated woman. She was, she still is a very educated woman. She was married to a world-renowned physicist, so she was in a very academic world, a very intellectual world. In addition to just loss of memory, some of the things that have changed, and some of them, oddly enough, kind of for the better. I mean, she used to be a very kind of rigid, judgmental, you know, sort of uptight person. And with the Alzheimer's, and I don't know exactly why, I have some theories, but that sort of fell away. She became a much more accepting, much more affectionate, demonstrative, emotional, outgoing. She's extremely, extremely social now, which is very strange because she's no longer able to say a sentence that I can even begin to decipher what the topic might be. But that doesn't mean she's not very, very communicative and very verbal and very social. And she's in a home with 38 other people, and she's absolutely one of the social butterflies of the place, and that's not remotely the type of person she used to be.
She first started losing her memory in the early 1980s, but it took years before there was an actual diagnosis.
Yeah.
Why did it take so long?
Well, there are a few things I can say in my defense, and then the rest is just because I was, you know, unwilling to face the obvious.
In other words, you didn't have a diagnosis because you didn't take her for one.
Right, exactly, because I just couldn't face it. But in my defense, she had such a slow and long decline, so that she actually began, in retrospect, I realized, she began showing signs of the disease before I had literally even heard the name of the disease. I mean, I clearly remember the first time somebody said to me, "Maybe she has Alzheimer's," and I said, "What's that?" And they described it to me, and I said, "Oh, I don't think so. Don't be ridiculous." And I stayed in that "I don't think so, don't be ridiculous" mode for an embarrassingly long amount of time. And partly because I knew Alzheimer's was a progressive disease, and if she had had strokes that had caused this, then it wasn't necessarily progressive. So I liked that idea a lot better. And taking her to the doctor was her, that was the activity she hated the most. So I essentially just, I just avoided it as long as I possibly could till it absolutely wasn't possible to continue avoiding anymore.
What was the turning point for you when you decided it was time to put her in a home?
Well, there were two things. One was that I had I had started to have some home care for her so that she just had somebody with her preventing anything from really catastrophic happening. And I had the home care up to 12 hours a day, and that was still not enough, and yet she wasn't willing to tolerate somebody staying overnight. So there was this terrible fear, oh, my God, what is she doing in the middle of the night? She might wake up and walk out on the street in her pajamas and, you know, wander for 2 hours. So something had to change. And also, I felt she was giving me advice. And you know, everything was done in such a non-direct, or maybe probably is direct, but such a non-traditionally verbal way. So she became obsessed at one point with packing suitcases. And as with all the obsessions, it happened then all the time, daily, multiple times a day. And no matter what I would do, I mean, I would take suitcases away and I would unpack them. I would try and ask, where are you going? Where do you want to go? But I couldn't get direct answers. No matter what I did, she continued in this packing mode. I mean, she'd find anything. She'd find, you know, an empty box from a cereal and put some things in it. Everything was always packing. And I, you know, chose to interpret that as meaning something, that she was somehow communicating that she wasn't feeling at home where she was. She had some desire to pack and go somewhere else. And she also was a lot of times standing in her apartment, her home, and saying, I want to go home now. So one of the reasons why I'd been reluctant to move her was, but how can I take her out of her home where she's comfortable? She's surrounded by familiar things. And I realized she's not comfortable. She's not surrounded by familiar things. These things are not familiar to her. She wants to go home, and she is home. So how it can't get any worse. Bottom line, it got to the point where I felt like it can't be worse if I move her, because she's already not at home in her home. So I realized I had to.
My guest is filmmaker Deborah Hoffman. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Deborah Hoffman. Her new documentary is about her mother, who has Alzheimer's disease. What do you talk about?
Well, that's very hard to answer because we talk nonstop, or rather she talks nonstop, and I try to make appropriate comments, but I no longer have any idea ever what the topic is. Now, she has a very large vocabulary. She talks very, very much and very expressively. There are certain points where she pauses and laughs, and certain points she sort of shrugs, and, you know, she has all the right, you know, trappings of a conversation. But, well, I'll give you a good example. Her kind of best pal at the home where she is a woman whose first language was Japanese. And I've noticed that people who have two languages with Alzheimer's, they tend to go back to their childhood language. So this woman speaks only Japanese, and I suspect she speaks a Japanese that's about as comprehensible as my mother's English. So she will speak, I assume, nonsensical Japanese to my mother, who will listen in with just rapt attention. And then she, you know, the friend will pause, and they'll both laugh and nod and agree and embrace, and then my mother will begin with nonsensical English, and the same thing will happen. And they will converse with each other for hours, but there's no way that they have a clue what each other is saying.
You know, in your film, I found this very interesting. You said that there was one point where you decided to stop trying to always correct your mother when she got something wrong, or when she didn't understand what your relationship was and assumed that you were somebody else, you decided, well, what's the point? I'll just play along with it.
Mm-hmm.
What was the turning point for you?
Well, the turning point was a very silly little thing. And it had to do with what month it was. And I was on the telephone with her, and she had said it was a month that it wasn't. And, you know, as was my habit those days, I felt it was important to tell her what month it really was, because I, you know, with the best of intentions, I was trying to kind of keep her oriented and help her function and things. And the conversation became really, really dreadful rather quickly, to the point where she was reduced to tears because she could not understand when I kept saying it was August. She just couldn't understand what it was I was saying. And, you know, she had a calendar in front of her and she started telling me that August wasn't in her calendar. And I mean, it just was utterly out of control. And I realized that I, you know, she had just made a little mistake. She thought it was May, big deal. And by my going off on that and insisting she understand it's August, I had created such pain and confusion for her and panic. I mean, to the point where I hung up the phone and this is another example of how idiotic I got. I hung up the phone. I said, well, I'll be right over. I'll show you August in your calendar. And of course, and by the time I arrive, why on earth are you here? And I don't care about August being in the calendar. You know, it was such a clear example that the problem through that whole interchange was so much more mine than hers. If I had just let her say it was May and let it go by, we would never have had any of this madness that had followed.
So what are some of the things you've since had to play along with?
Well, you know, it's 2 years have gone by since I stopped filming. So the footage in the film is a lot more coherent than the way things are now. So now it's not a matter of going along with any specifics. It's just kind of floating along with who knows what. But it used to be. I mean, there were many, many things I went along with. You know, I was her cousin. I had gone to elementary school with her. A very, very common favorite one was that we were in college together. And we, as I mentioned in the film, I mean, we would reminisce about the days in the sorority. And she would ask me if I'd seen any of the AE5 girls lately. And rather than go into my long explanation of how I couldn't have seen them lately because I wasn't in AE5 when she was because I'm her daughter and blah, 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 I would kind of just throw it back and then see what she had to say. So I would just say, no, I haven't seen any of the AE5 girls lately. How about you? And that would kind of free her up to make up some stories about whether she had or hadn't seen AE5 girls lately and things like that.
Now, something else I thought was interesting in your film, you're gay and your partner is a woman, and you say in the film that your mother, although she never condemned it, she was never quite comfortable with it either. But that seemed to change a little bit when she got sick.
Changed enormously. And it's part of this whole thing where something in her lightened up. There was some sort of, she expresses now a kind of freedom she never had. And I included it in the film for a number of reasons. I found it so interesting that this discomfort that she felt with my being gay appeared to actually have no foundation. It appeared to be, you know, something about, well, what will the neighbors think? I mean, it was in that realm. And that kind of realm of what will the neighbors think disappeared very early on with the illness. So she saw things in a much more, you know, from her own gut. And her own gut was, well, she really, really was crazy about my partner. And, you know, the idea of thinking there was something wrong with it was just, was as ludicrous an idea as I believe it is. And so it wasn't just that she changed a little. I mean, she became deeply comfortable with me and Francis. I mean, to the point where if I would go visit her without Francis, she would always, well, where's Francis? And what was interesting was, you know, her memory was so bad and certainly for names was so bad, but she, to this day, knows Francis's name, which is extraordinary. There's not my name and Francis's name are the only names she knows.
You've spent a lot of time taking care of your mother in her old age.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you don't have children.
That's right.
Now, do you worry about this, that there won't be a daughter to take care of you when you reach your mother's age?
Very much. Very much. And in terms of the taking care of my mother, at the point that I resented it the most, and I did certainly resent it for, you know, when it was taking over my life, one of the things I would say was, this is not fair. I didn't have children for a reason, and now I have the equivalent of a child. Ultimately, I don't regret any of it. I feel like it was actually an extraordinary experience for me. But yes, I worry very much, because first of all, they do say that there's a strong genetic component to Alzheimer's. And no, I don't have a dutiful daughter that is waiting in the wings. But that's kind of the end of my answer. Yes, I worry. I haven't come up with a solution yet.
Are you hoping that there will be all kinds of like alternative models for older people by the time you're old?
Well, I'm hoping for a lot of things.
You're right. Yeah.
I'm hoping very soon for a cure for Alzheimer's. as I lose my keys daily, I'm waiting for that to come. And I'm hoping for a very different system. There's a sort of insane thing that goes on in the health system here. If you have Alzheimer's, the kind of care that you ultimately need is custodial care rather than medical care, and that is not covered by anything. So, for instance, the facility that my mother's in, which is quite wonderful, you can't be there if you don't have the funds to be there. So what most people end up doing, and I figure without a daughter to look out of, for me, this is what someone would do with me, you take a person with Alzheimer's and you put them in a nursing home rather than a care facility. And a nursing home is not what they need, and a nursing home is not capable or equipped to care for them. And that's how they end up, ultimately, the nursing home can't deal with the person with Alzheimer's because they're agitated and they're wandering, and so they give them drugs to calm them down, but they're still wandering, so then they put them in restraints. And it's the worst, and it costs way more than a care facility, but it's covered. So it's the worst of all possible scenarios. It's the worst possible care at the most possible cost. And that's what most people in this country now do. So I certainly hope that will have changed by the time I get there.
Which mother do you most want to remember, or are you able to hold the memory of your mother before and after she got sick in your mind at the same time?
I'm not easily able to hold both in my mind. It's interesting. I'm much more aware of the current mother these days. And I imagine that when my mother dies, I'm in for a big shock, because I suspect that that's when it's going to be when I'm suddenly flooded with the memories of who she used to be. I think I just can't allow myself to remember that too much. And there's so much kind of happening in the present and it's not as if she's faded away. She has such a strong personality presently that I focus on that, and I don't much think about who she used to be.
Forgive me if this is an annoying or overly heavy question, but, you know, your mother has forgotten everything about her life except her childhood. So she's, you know, she's forgotten any work that she did. She's forgotten her family. I mean, she's forgotten mm-hmm. you and her and your father. Mm-hmm. Does this lead you to this kind of existential despair of, you know, well, what's the point of anything anyways? If you're going to end up like this and forget everything good and bad that ever happened to you?
Well, I think that one of the reasons I probably made this film was so that when I'm like that, you know, there'll be something that remains, and I'm hoping it'll be this film, and I'll be one of those obnoxious people in the home that walks around and grabs everybody and says, you got to come look at my film, and I put it in the VCR, and I'll have this tangible reminder of something that I did.
Deborah Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Deborah Hoffman's documentary, Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter, will be shown Tuesday night on the PBS series POV. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, how in the last days of the Cold War, the granddaughter of a former president fell in love with and married the head of the Soviet space program. We talk with Susan Eisenhower. And if you haven't yet surfed the internet, Stephen Levy, Newsweek's technology columnist, has a few hints on getting started. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida officials say the storm surge from Tropical Storm Allison has flooded more than 65 coastal homes along the Gulf Coast. There have been reports of storm surges of up to 8 feet. The storm is weakening after making landfall in the Florida Panhandle. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has opened a command center in Atlanta to coordinate possible responses to Allison. The former hurricane is breaking up, but it still poses a tornado threat to the southeast. A federal grand jury in Miami has indicted 6 criminal defense attorneys for money laundering and other drug-related charges. The lawyers are accused of helping drug kingpins from the notorious Cali cartel. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
A former chief of international affairs at the U.S. Justice Department and 2 former federal prosecutors are among 6 criminal defense attorneys charged in a massive indictment against the Cali cartel. Miami U.S. Attorney Kendall Coffey says the lawyers crossed the line from defending their clients to helping the Cali cartel launder drug profits, intimidate witnesses, and get sensitive information.
We cannot have an honest system if the powers vested in lawyers are corrupted.
3 of the 6 lawyers have already pleaded guilty to lesser charges, and the 3 others are expected to surrender Wednesday. They all were named as part of a larger indictment, which charges some 60 other people, including 4 principal leaders of the Cali cartel. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
2 more jurors have been dismissed from the O.J. Simpson murder trial jury. Judge Lance Ito says testimony will be delayed to allow the defense to file an appeal with a higher state court. Testimony has been canceled for the day. Meanwhile, the appeal will try to overturn Judge Ito's order. There are just 2 alternate jurors left on the O.J. Simpson murder panel. President Clinton is calling on members of Congress to give up scores of amendments to his anti-terrorism legislation so that the bill can be passed quickly. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
As requested by Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole, President Clinton is calling on Senate Democrats to scale back dozens of amendments to his anti-terrorism bill, saying the bill should pass without delay.
I call upon my fellow Democrats and Republicans to limit amendments, curb politics, ignore narrow interests, to agree to the simple pact that there should be no excuses, no games, no delays.
The bill would, among other things, expand the federal government's wiretap authority. Dole says the bill could be introduced as early as tomorrow. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
IBM is moving to buy Lotus Development. Big Blue is offering $60 a share for the software company. That's $3.3 billion. On Wall Street, stock prices closed at another record high today. The Dow gained 32 points to close at 4,476. This is NPR News. Yemen has extradited a man to Germany who's believed to have worked closely with terrorist Carlos the Jackal. Carlos was arrested last year by French authorities. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
47-year-old Johannes Weinrich, who was wanted in Germany in connection with numerous terrorist actions in the 1970s and 80s, arrived in Berlin last night. German prosecutors suspect he was involved in attacks on the Berlin Cultural Center, Maison de France, an attack on Radio Free Europe in Munich, and the hijacking of an El Al plane to Entebbe. In addition, he is wanted by French authorities for a bomb attack on Israeli planes at Paris's Orly Airport. At least 12 people died as a result of the attacks. German intelligence officials say the German left-wing extremists met the South American terrorist Carlos in the 1970s. In the early 1980s, Weinrich allegedly managed Carlos's European operations, shuttling between East Berlin and Hungary. Yemenite authorities worked together with German criminal officials to arrest him last year near Eden. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Authorities say 1 person died and 60 people were injured this morning in the crash of 2 subway trains in New York City. A transit authority spokesman says that a Manhattan-bound train was struck from behind by another train on the Williamsburg Bridge over the East River. Another transit authority said the operator of the second train died as the nose of his vehicle crashed into the first train. Officials say the first train may have been stopped on the tracks. It's not clear how serious many of the injuries are. A published report says the nation's blood supply would be safer if the government had a better tracking system. The Wall Street Journal has published a government audit finding the Food and Drug Administration doesn't force hospitals and blood banks to turn in error reports quickly enough. The paper cites the audit, which says the FDA doesn't get any such reports from facilities that take care of about 10% of the blood that is used in the United States. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1987, when the Cold War was still on, the granddaughter of a former U.S. president met the head of the Soviet space program. They fell in love, while the CIA and KGB looked on. As the Soviet Union disintegrated, they married. My guest is Susan Eisenhower. She's written a new book called Breaking Free, a memoir of love and revolution. Her grandfather, Dwight Eisenhower, was president in the early years of the Cold War. Susan is an expert on Soviet affairs. She met her husband, Roald Sagdiev, at a conference she helped organize, which brought together policymakers from the U.S. and Soviet Union to engage in public debate. Sagdiev was an advisor to Gorbachev at the time. She met him the first evening at the conference at a barbecue.
The great opening line of the romance, I mean, if you can believe it, is he came up to me at this party and introduced himself and asked me if my grandfather was serious about the military-industrial complex. I was slightly annoyed by the remark because I thought, gee whiz, you know, do we have to be answering this question every time we go out? And I said, I think he was perfectly serious. But then I said, and we can't wait for the day when the Soviet Union will admit that it has a military-industrial complex too. You know, the Soviet Union had traditionally used this notion of the military-industrial complex as propaganda against defense contractors who make profits on, legislation, that sort of thing, that enables them to build these weapons systems, etc. But instead of, you know, going through the whole, you know, American profit-making motive and all this long polemic response, he leaned forward and he said, of course the Soviet Union has a military-industrial complex. He says, I work with those guys, and they shamelessly chase contracts, too. Well, I must say, I was completely floored, because not only was he the first Soviet ever to say anything even remotely like this, but the fact that he announced that he worked within the complex as well really made me very embarrassed and almost unwilling to go further with the conversation.
When did you and Roald Sagdiev realize you were beginning to have feelings for each other?
Well, I think he'd probably tell you that it happened for him earlier than it did for me. I must say, I was quite suspicious of him, to be perfectly honest with you. He had a reputation of being very bright and open, and many people admired him, though they were wary of him, because he brought glasnost to the civilian space program in the Soviet Union long before Gorbachev came onto the scene. But I myself had been raised in a very cautious way, and I was, you know, deeply suspicious, really, of everything Soviet. While I wanted to see an improvement in our relations, I had no illusions about who the authorities would put before me. So I was pretty cautious about the whole thing.
So you wouldn't allow yourself to feel anything early on?
Oh, I didn't allow myself at all. And in fact, as I began slowly to develop some feelings for him, I really was quite determined to keep the brakes on, to minimize my exposure to him. But he was extremely persistent.
How did you test him to figure out whether he was really using you for political ends or whether he really cared for you?
Well, I'm not sure there was really any way to test him. It's just that over the course of time, he began to talk to me more and more about the condition of his society and the way he saw the future of the regime going. And I was so impressed by his honesty and his openness. He frequently said things that were, I guess, could be regarded as anti-Soviet in nature. Again, of course, I had to be very cautious about that, too, because certainly in the old days, KGB people would be sort of planted to be similarly open. I did actually at one point confront him about his ties to the intelligence community, and he laughed and said, listen, I'm a member of the American Academy of Sciences. You think they didn't do a background check on me? I was a little embarrassed I'd asked him, because by that time I already knew perfectly well that he was a scientist, and international scientists often have their own frame of reference for how they view the world.
When you started to get to know each other, it was in a pretty official capacity. You were both at conferences. But when you wanted to get away and talk a little bit more personally, where could you go without looking suspicious or feeling uncomfortable?
Well, there was virtually no place to go for an extremely long period of time. In fact, we were with what in the old days would have been regarded as a chaperone, I guess. But under these circumstances, it was slightly more sinister. When we were in Moscow, of course, Roald had his chauffeur driver who never left him alone. And he had his assistant who stuck with us like glue. And when he came to the United States, of course, he was always assigned a so-called escort. They were notoriously individuals who worked for the intelligence community who were there to make sure that a person like Sagdeyev wouldn't defect while he was in the United States or on some foreign trip. So, I mean, we were around people constantly. And, of course, this was one of the big challenges because as I wanted to know more and more about who he was as a person, it was very hard to find time and place to be alone, or indeed out of earshot. I mean that quite literally, because many of the rooms, probably most of them, that we were in the Soviet Union were bugged anyway.
Did you have any evidence that you were under surveillance by the KGB or the CIA?
Well, you know, evidence, it's hard to say. I'm convinced that we were. I had terrible problems with my telephone at the office and also my home phone.
You think that was the CIA or the KGB?
Well, I'm not sure how it works technically. In fact, some people will say that it's impossible for the KGB to tap phones within the United States. Without really addressing myself to that question, because I'm afraid I don't know the technical details, I can only say that after I would be back from a trip for a certain period of time, like after I'd been back for a month or so, all of the interference and this slightly high-pitched beep would go away. And certainly, as our relationship developed, there was no question that we were under surveillance by the KGB. Years later, I had this well-confirmed by a person who reported to those authorities. But we were aware of it, and of course it created a tremendous pressure, really.
Something that I'm sure must have added even more pressure to your situation was that you are the granddaughter of the late Dwight Eisenhower, a former president of the United States. So your behavior, especially in the political arena during the Cold War, had to be above and beyond reproach.
Well, that's true. And the thing is that, you know, I loved my grandparents deeply, and I took all this very seriously. I mean, I feel like I am a steward of the Eisenhower name, and this was on my mind a lot as this relationship developed. I guess, though, over the course of time, everybody has to live his or her own life, and this is part of what this book is about, is really coming to terms with my own rights to have a life of my own and actually for him to do the same.
My guest is Susan Eisenhower. She's written a book called Breaking Free, a memoir of love and revolution. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Susan Eisenhower. She's written a memoir about how she, the granddaughter of an American president, fell in love with and married the head of the Soviet space program. You were advised at one point to keep the relationship as open as possible. Who gave you that advice, and why did they give it to you?
Well, a very dear friend of mine, who is now a federal judge, as a matter of fact, a man named Paul Michel, warned me. He was the only person I'd confided in, but we'd been such old friends that I thought, you know, he would certainly keep my confidence. And he had been on the Senate Intelligence Committee many years before, and while no longer had ties to the intelligence community, would certainly know what we were up against, and that is Roald and I. And he absolutely advised. First of all, he thought I was crazy to be in love with somebody like this in the first place, but he warned me very, very strongly to keep everything as open as possible, because he said that if we were seen sneaking off or going places, that the KGB could well assume that he was passing secrets to me. You see, I wouldn't have had any secrets to convey to Sagdeyev, but certainly Sagdeyev knew plenty, and that they might, if they didn't actually have proof of it, the implication, of course, was is that they could set me up as a way to, discredit me or evict me from the country or make sure I never came back. And actually, I think Paul Michel's advice was very sound. Because
did you follow it?
Yes, I would say in very large measure. I mean, there were certainly times towards the end where we decided to hell with it. We're not going to live like this anymore. But that was really partially, a decision that sprang out of the fact that by playing this game with the regime, you actually let them win. And that was a very big turning point for me, because there were huge personal risks. I mean, risks to people's reputations, to my husband's safety, or the man who had become my husband's safety. But at a certain point, it's very, very difficult to continue playing other people's games. And so there was a moment when Roland and I decided that we weren't going to play this game anymore, and if the Soviet authorities were going to do something to us, then they'd have to do it to us. But we weren't going to pass up the rare moments we had together to be, continuing to orchestrate our relationship on such a peculiar and unnatural footing.
What was your family's reaction?
Well, my family, I thought, reacted very well. I was very proud of them and very touched. All of them supported the wedding. My father actually came to the wedding in Moscow, and they really took an immediate liking to Roland and understood what it was I was doing. My father is a remarkable person. I think he understood, many years before that his siblings had their own lives, and it was important that he support them while they live them. And so I was very lucky in that, because he never once raised the notion that this might be a political or a social scandal of any kind.
Let me change the subject a little bit. How did you find out that your grandfather was president? Did someone in your family tell you? Did you see him on TV and go, wait a minute?
Well, I think the first clue here was that we had Secret Service men from
right.
the time.
That's a good clue.
That's right. And I was about 18 months old when he was elected, so I literally grew up with him. But, in a very strange way, you are a product of your own surroundings. And I wouldn't say that I assumed everybody else had big, tall men who followed them out onto the playgrounds at school. But it seemed very natural to me. The thing is, though, is that one got older and older, one realized how much of an oddity this really was. You do have to admit that there is some glorious irony in this whole story of being followed around as a child by the Secret Service men and then followed around as an adult by the KGB.
Absolutely.
It's occurred to me more than once. But I must say that it was great preparation, because as a child, in a very strange way, I had some notion that people were really watching me, and I don't mean that in a sinister way. It's just that one understood that being well-behaved was an important part of getting along with your parents anyway, and getting along with the Secret Service men, etc. But I did grow up feeling like I lived in a fishbowl, so when it came time to organizing my behavior with respect to the KGB, I found out I was pretty adept at it.
This year is the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. VE Day ceremonies have already taken place, and in August it's the end of the war with Japan. These occasions must have special significance for you. Your grandfather was so important in the American military, in leading the war, and America and Russia were allies during World War II.
Well, that's right. They were allies. Unfortunately, the alliance didn't last for very long, because Stalin had bred into every bit of his personality a deep sense of suspicion. In fact, there was a great deal of hope in the Soviet Union after World War II that Stalin would relax his grasp on the country. But in fact, the exposure to the Western world threatened Stalin deeply. So in fact, the iron hand of the dictator was felt even more strongly after World War II. Actually, the whole period is really a very sad period, the business of the Cold War. But I think that my grandfather, anyway, not only his wartime legacy was important to me, but I, you know, in reading some of his work now, I understand how much he understood the nature of the Soviet regime. And I think one thing that made it psychologically possible for me to marry Roald is that there's no question in my own mind that my grandfather had a very understood the clear distinction between the Soviet regime and the people themselves. Now, while Roald obviously was part of that regime in some respects, he had his own independent viewpoint, and I think one that my grandfather would have appreciated a great deal.
Do you and your husband have a lot of political disagreements?
Practically none. I mean, it's really scary. No, in fact, I often joke about the fact that at the time of our marriage, he was a Soviet and I was American, and he was a Muslim and I was christened Episcopalian, and he was a member of the Communist Party and I was a registered Republican. I mean, what a contrast on every front. But I don't know what it is. Maybe it is the scientific culture that he was part of. Maybe there is a kind of internationalism that exists. I don't know, but we agree on virtually everything politically. I'm not sure that he would make a good Republican by some standards today, but we certainly are very much in agreement on most things.
Susan Eisenhower, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, nice to talk to you.
Susan Eisenhower's new memoir is called Breaking Free. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from Elizabeth Arnold about the back and forth between Congress and the White House over the anti-terrorism bill. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about a famous African-American aviatrix and why she's on a U.S. postage stamp. We'll be following a man you've interviewed, Floyd Cochran, the former Area Nations spokesman, around a speaking tour in Oregon, and hearing from psychologist Raphael Ezekiel about what attracted a group of young Detroit men whom he studied to a Nazi hate group there. And we'll be hearing today about what's going on in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The summer rerun season may give you a reason to leave your TV off and get in front of your computer screen more often. Commentator Stephen Levy says your TV may stay dark.
Lately, the technologically challenged folks of my acquaintance have been asking me what all this business is about computer nets. Should I get online, they want to know, shuddering at the prospect. I always reassure them that no, their very survival does not depend on acquiring a modem immediately. But I do say that if they are at all interested in the frontiers of our culture or simply witnessing one of the most interesting things going on these days, they owe it to themselves to check out what's happening on the World Wide Web. I don't tell them that doing so will suck them into a black hole where all their free time will be swallowed up by endless hours in front of a computer screen. I figure they'll find that out for themselves. Instead, I try to explain what this ominous-sounding World Wide Web really is. Only a couple of years ago, some clever nerds in Switzerland figured out a good way to store information that came in several media: text, graphics, animation, video, and sound. Furthermore, this approach included an easy way to get from one location or website to another. You could build in what are called links, letting users jump directly from one document to another anywhere on the web. In effect, surfing through cyberspace. At first, not many people used the web. But then some undergraduates at the University of Illinois came up with an easy-to-use piece of software called a browser that lets you navigate the web by pointing and clicking a mouse. After that, things took off. Now, fueled by the prospect of an instant audience, people have set up hundreds of thousands of websites for public viewing, and dozens of new ones pop up every day. They are like pieces in a mammoth library where all the books are interconnected, and anyone can automatically toss their own book on the pile. Or you could view the web as the ultimate blockbuster franchise with no rental fees. And one day, the web might be the way most new media are published. Everything from magazines to rap music. In other words, that vaunted information superhighway begins right here. What's on the web? Just about anything you could imagine. Some locations are goofy, like the site that lets you examine the closet of a teenage girl in Canada. Then there's the site connected to a live camera beamed directly on a coffee pot in a faculty room at Oxford University. Supposedly it's for the benefit of people in that building, but thousands of people all over the world, including me, check it often, just because it's there. Other sites are actually useful, like a repository of documents about the Holocaust or the current status of pending federal legislation. Increasingly, you see commercial websites. The entertainment business in particular loves to promote new products on the web. You could sample songs from unknown punk rock bands or view clips from upcoming movies. And in the next few months, it will be possible to make secure credit card transactions over the net, and people will treat the web like a virtual shopping mall. Despite the rapid changes on the web, there is one constant: the coolest sites rule. Everyone is on the lookout for new, innovative websites that break new ground in this multimedium. There are even special sites that do nothing but launch you straight to hot new locations. And it's just as likely that a great site will be created by a college student in Omaha as by a billion-dollar company. The web is nothing if not egalitarian. How does one get access to the web? Basically, you need a computer, a fast modem, and an internet gateway. And then you could view for yourself the first wonder of the virtual world, an amazing, collaboratively constructed, uncensored crazy quilt of research material, commerce, and art. But be forewarned, web surfing is like digital nicotine. You could easily find yourself glued to the screen for hours, jumping from site to site, waiting to see what comes up next. After a few weeks, your family and friends will probably miss you, and maybe even complain about your absence. Tell them to lighten up. After all, there are worse things than being addicted to the future.
Stephen Levy is the technology columnist for Newsweek and the author of Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the Computer That Changed Everything. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike, research assistance from Becky Cohen. Alan Tu directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional funding comes from Fairer, Strauss, and Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jeffrey Canada has spent 20 years working with poor inner-city children. He says they're growing up in a war zone, but unlike soldiers, they have no safe home to return to after a tour of duty. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Canada, who has written a personal memoir of violence in America. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.